President Trump announces new rules for seeking asylum in the U.S.
Effectively, this makes it impossible for anyone to apply for asylum at the U.S. southern border unless they are Mexican or unless they applied for and were denied asylum in Mexico.
Plus, Ebola has been confirmed in the large city of Goma in eastern Congo. The work to contain the virus there is urgent.
The work has to be done in the next 72 hours, but there could be ongoing transmission that we're not aware of for several more days after that.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories. Also, what does Bruce Lee have to do with the protests in Hong Kong?
The water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Be water, my friend. We'll explain today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Go back to your country. That's not just Donald Trump's view of certain members of Congress. Today, it's the president's preferred policy for many asylum seekers. The administration is set to publish a new rule declaring that the United States will no longer accept claims for asylum from people who have passed through a third country. So, for example, someone from El Salvador who has passed through Guatemala and Mexico could be sent back to one of those countries or even sent home. The Trump administration would like the new rule to take effect as soon as it's published tomorrow, but it is very likely to be immediately challenged in court. Sarah Pierce is an attorney and a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. Let's start right at the beginning. What is an asylum seeker? What's the definition, Sarah?
Sure. An asylum seeker is someone who is outside of his or her country of nationality. They're unable or unwilling to return because they have a fear of persecution in their home country.
So tell us what this new rule is changing exactly.
So the new rule is adding a bar onto who can apply for asylum. And it's saying that if you passed through a third country and you didn't apply for and were denied asylum in that third country, then you cannot apply for asylum in the United States. Effectively, this makes it impossible for anyone to apply for asylum at the U.S. southern border unless they are Mexican or unless they applied for and were denied asylum in Mexico.
But aren't there international treaties and protocols that define the rights of asylum seekers, which the U.S. is signatory to? I mean, can the U.S. simply change these rules on a whim?
So, yes, the United States has to answer to these international treaties and obligations with regards to our asylum policy. But the administration is hoping that a provision that we put into our laws called withholding of removal can really save them here. So when an individual applies for asylum at the southern border and they're subject to this new regulation, they'll still be permitted to apply for something called withholding of removal, which is a really bare bones benefit. It effectively says, for right now, we won't deport you. We'll also give you temporary work authorization. But it's a really high bar to qualify for withholding of removal. It's much more difficult to qualify for that than it was to apply for asylum.
Don't Mexico and Guatemala, don't they have a say on who gets sent back to their countries from the United States?
They do. That's true. They could try to slow walk any of these deportations if they wanted to. I think they would face a lot of pressure from the United States if they did that.
I mean, technically, if people are fleeing violence in, say, El Salvador, if they are only seeking safety, surely they could claim asylum in any country they enter, like Mexico, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that would be the first country somebody from Guatemala, say, steps on.
Yeah, they can absolutely apply for asylum in Mexico. It's just, it's not a guarantee that that is a safe country for them, and it's definitely not a guarantee that they'll get asylum.
Any of these international treaties that the U.S. is signatory to, what action could they take if Trump creates this rule?
So there's no international policing organization that tries to ensure that all countries are respecting the rights of asylum seekers. There is UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency. They're kind of tasked with enforcing the Refugee Convention. They could call out a player on the international stage saying that they're not abiding by international laws and norms, but they're unlikely to do so, especially with the United States, because the United States heavily funds UNHCR. So it's unlikely that the United States would face any international consequences for this. It's more likely that the administration might get caught up by our own court system in the United States. It sounds like several groups are going to try to challenge this regulation right away.
Right. I mean, it's supposed to be taking effect tomorrow, this rule. As soon as it's published, do you think it will take effect?
Yeah, I do think it's more likely than not it'll take effect.
Even with pushback from courts.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do expect advocates to file right away. So the question is whether or not it'll be enjoined right away. The closest case we have to compare this to is the asylum ban, when the administration tried to make it impossible for anyone to apply for asylum if they crossed the southern border illegally. That was quickly enjoined after, I think, like 10 days by federal courts. But I think there was,
Enjoined, in other words, it was taken on by judges.
yeah, but I think there was a much stronger legal argument for advocates in that case than there is in this one. In that case, it was clearly counter to federal law and the original intent of Congress. In this one, I don't think they can point to a federal law that clearly counters it quite as easily. So I think they're going to have a little bit more of an uphill battle.
Sarah Pierce with the Migration Policy Institute. Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
The Ebola virus is spreading in Africa. The epidemic began in the Democratic Republic of the Congo nearly a year ago. The virus has killed now more than 1,600 people there. And it's now reached the Congolese city of Goma, home to 2 million people. The head of the World Health Organization described the discovery in Goma as a game changer. The new case prompted an emergency meeting of international health leaders today. David Gressley took part. He's the Ebola response coordinator for the United Nations. So tell us what you know about this case in Goma. In what ways is it a big deal?
Well, the main concern is that, first of all, it's outside the area where this virus has been circulating for the last year. It's come much further south. But more importantly is what Goma represents. It's a major hub, transport hub for the country, but also outside of the country. Of course, it's along the border with Rwanda. So, and it's a large urban area, and Ebola, if a chain of transmission starts in a large urban area, is quite complex to manage. So this is something that we have feared that might happen. And now that it has, the preparedness that's been put in place over the last few months is now starting to kick in. But it's a serious issue, and we're quite concerned about it.
Elaborate a bit more on Goma itself, where it is and why this particular city represents a challenging and, in fact, fragile moment in the progression of this outbreak.
Well, it's by far the largest urban area on the eastern side of the country. It's surrounded by areas of conflict that have been going on for the last 20 years. But it's also an area of commerce, both in and outside the country. Goma itself is relatively secure. It's a diverse population as well, with people coming from different parts of North Kivu province. But on the other hand, there are a lot of preparations already in place. The Ebola Treatment Center here is being made operational as we speak. What I should say in addition is that the individual who did arrive was immediately identified as potential Ebola suspect, was isolated immediately. He has now been transferred back to Butembo, which was his original start of his trip here. So we also have work to do not only in Goma, but on the whole path from where he started, actually in Beni, then Butembo, and then Goma.
Well, I mean, it really shows kind of just all the precautions that you need to take and over a wide stretch of geographical area. This meeting, David Gressley, that you took part in with these other international health leaders, did any countries commit new money to this crisis? And how much urgency and concern has grown around this individual in Goma who has contracted Ebola now?
Well, the meeting was scheduled already as a way of looking at the next phase of the response. It was decided that there's a need to basically take a multi-sectoral approach to this, bringing in different government ministries, and of course from our side on the international community, likewise looking at different issues of security, how to support that with the peacekeeping mission, but also humanitarian assistance coming in. So a whole of UN approach, basically. Mm. But the case in Goma resonated very well in the meeting because it's a reminder that there's no place for complacency here.
So since this outbreak began last year, there are currently more than 1,600 deaths reported, a number of healthcare workers who have been killed. As you look into the coming months, what are you planning for in terms of best case and worst case scenarios?
By working for the best, I think we have to do two major things. Number one, we really have to find ways to stop the interruptions to this response due to insecurity, due to political protests, due to non-payment of salaries. Any stoppage that lasts for more than a few hours allows the virus to continue to multiply. And if it's for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, you get a significant increase in cases. So you can't afford these interruptions. Secondly, we need to make sure we're not blind, that the virus can't go somewhere and propagate undetected. And then we only see it when there's many cases suddenly coming forward. At risk areas where there's no virus circulating right now, we need really good surveillance in those areas. We need really good contact monitoring those areas. This whole epidemic became a major problem because it went undetected for more than 3 months before the epidemic was declared in August. That allowed it to create multiple chains of transmission that have been very difficult to track and trace. We can't afford for that to continue to happen. So we have to work to end the interruptions, to end the blind spots, and bring this thing to closure.
David Gressley, Ebola Response Coordinator for the UN in Goma, DRC. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you. My pleasure.
England's 50-pound banknote will soon have a new face, that of British mathematician Alan Turing. Turing was a World War II war hero who was later prosecuted for being gay. His code cracking helped the Allies decipher encrypted messages from Nazi Germany. Turing's work helped shorten the war and saved an incalculable number of lives. 5 years ago, Hollywood told the story of how Turing cracked the Enigma, Germany's code machine.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
No, I don't. 3.
While we've been having this conversation.
The film, The Imitation Game, also explained what happened to Turing after the war. He was convicted for gross indecency for having an affair with a man. Homosexuality was illegal in Britain until 1967. And as punishment for the crime of homosexuality, Turing was chemically castrated. He died by suicide before those laws were changed. For decades, the idea of honoring a gay man on an English banknote frankly seemed impossible. Turing's grandniece, Rachel Barnes, called today's announcement brilliant, and she believes his appeal is partly because who ultimately became his enemy?
Because he was persecuted by the government who he worked for. And I think, you know, people sort of feel attached to him because of that.
When you consider why Turing will be on the 50-pound note, simple. He's considered one of the fathers of computer science and artificial intelligence.
He came up with the initial concept of a machine that could be used to solve any computable problem, what we now know as a computer.
Sarah John there, the Bank of England's chief cashier, her signature will be the one on the new banknotes. The new bill will include a quote from Turing about the rise of machine intelligence. He said, "This is only a foretaste of what is to come and only the shadow of what is going to be." The new banknote will be in circulation by the end of 2021. You're with The World.
The World is supported by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. Safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having your personal data stolen. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/theworld. That's ExpressVPN.com/theworld for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Visit ExpressVPN.com/theworld to learn more. The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Huge demonstrations used to be a rarity in Hong Kong. Now they've become a new normal as opposition to mainland China's political influence grows. On Sunday, a protest in an area called Sha Tin, that's near the border with mainland China, started peacefully. Thousands of demonstrators marched through the streets demanding more political freedom. They're calling on officials to formally withdraw an extradition proposal that would allow Chinese courts to try Hong Kong citizens in mainland China. Several hours later, youth and security forces clashed in an upscale shopping mall, with police using pepper spray and batons to beat back protesters. Joshua Wong is one of Hong Kong's best-known pro-democracy activists. I asked him if protesters are trying to avoid violent confrontations with police.
No one would like to see anyone be injured or get hurt. But what we realize is police continue targeted citizens, activists, and even journalists, attack them with batons or pepper spray. It shows how Hong Kong government just rely on police force to suppress on the one who fight for political freedom and also press freedom.
So Joshua, what does that mean for you and the risks that you face as a pro-democracy advocate?
More than 100,000 people joined the rally on Sunday. It's because we are still urging government to terminate it and withdraw the extradition bill. At the same time, it's a must for Hong Kong people to fight for free election, especially when one country, two system eroded to be one country, one and a half system. That's why we continue our fight.
Doesn't it mean, though, that the protests become more risky to you and your personal safety the more you protest?
It's hard for every citizens to ensure their personal safety during protests and persist on the principle of nonviolence. They might still be targeted by police, attacked or beaten by them.
Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, says her security forces, quote, were intentionally attacked by people who, she says, I really think we can describe as rioters. That's the end of the quote. What is your response to that?
Carrie Lam must bear her responsibility to solve the political crisis generated by her. No one would love to see anyone be injured. But the most critical problem is police try to clear the protests that originally persist on peaceful principle. I think it's time for Hong Kong government to realize that they should accept the request from Hong Kong people, terminate the extradition bill immediately, and stop suppress on Hong Kong's people human rights.
And what if they don't do that? What is the opposition strategy in terms of violence and peaceful protests?
No one would like to see a clash of violence, but a massive protest might still continue.
What if the violence does not stop, and there's a very strong likelihood that it won't, that you will be attacked again by police? Are you worried that this atmosphere of violence will alienate some of your supporters?
When police use unnecessary and excessive force to target activists, and more than 100 activists were injured and sent to hospital in the past few weeks protests, it's just because people need to protect themselves with force. That's why, instead of allowing those clash become more often in the future, I think it's time for government let Hong Kong people to have free election and terminate the evil bill.
Joshua Wong, thanks very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Joshua Wong is one of Hong Kong's most vocal pro-democracy activists. Protesters have been expressing their thoughts and feelings through ways other than taking to the streets, through memes. There has been a whole bunch of them circulating online. Jason Lee has been keeping a close eye on them. He's a cartoonist and designer from Hong Kong. He told us he started noticing memes about the extradition bill as last month's protests were being planned.
I even found a thread in a forum in Hong Kong that was saying, like, hey, we should use memes to attract foreign media. You know, we want more international eyes on this issue. And so they sort of remixed certain American memes. There's one that's like Disaster Girl, this little kid looking at this burning house and smiling in evil way.
Yeah.
And using that to portray like our government not listening to the people.
Yeah. So what you're saying there, does that suggest that the memes have actually been crucial in getting so many people out in the streets of Hong Kong?
They've been one factor. I wouldn't say they've been the biggest part.
Well, memes are pretty visual, but let's try giving it a shot here on the radio because, I mean, some of them, and they're creative. So there's one about Chief Executive Carrie Lam of Hong Kong that comes up pretty frequently. How is she portrayed?
I think there's been like a couple of different portrayals. I think first, she was portrayed as a cruel person. For example, in a Disaster Girl meme with the little girl smiling at the burning house, the little girl was supposed to be Carrie Lam. And the burning house is supposed to be the future of Hong Kong. And so at first, she was kind of this Machiavellian, cruel sort of government official person. That evolved a little bit because Carrie Lam also gave a lot of press conferences and tried to sort of placate the masses by giving short speeches. And in one of them, she kind of called protesters her children that she needs to rein in, which obviously from a protester's point of view, a meme maker's point of view, was just like this great ammunition for creating memes. And so there's other memes where she's portrayed as like a mother wielding guns.
What about some prominent themes that you've noticed in these memes? Do you have an example or two of your favorites?
Yeah, there's been these bunch of memes around that circulate around this Bruce Lee quote talking about be water.
You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
It's both a motivating tactic, but also a way that I think protesters were sort of sharing the strategy amongst themselves. And the idea is kind of like, if the government or the police push, don't fight it, just pull back for now, and then swarm back in afterwards.
I mean, it sounds poetic, like, oh, but it's kind of instructions for how to operate in a demonstration.
Yeah.
So the protests over the extradition bill, the controversial extradition bill, that started at the end of March and then really heated up last month in June. Have the themes changed of the memes?
I've sort of identified roughly 3 to 4 different waves of memes. And so the beginning, I think, was more awareness raising and the cruelty of the government. And that morphed into after the protests on, particularly on June 12th, became violent and the police were caught on camera attacking protesters and even journalists. So there were a lot of police violence memes. The latest wave I've caught, I think there's been recently a lot of self-care memes. So let's take care of each other in low moments.
Well, self-care seems important. I mean, certainly for the demonstrators. What else do you think memes add to this whole conversation? Why do you spend your time kind of watching them and compiling them?
I mean, first, they're funny. I think we all agree. Right. But I think it's also what I've noticed from observing the memes in parallel with reading the articles is that I think memes also really just show the inner state or inner lives or inner emotions of the protesters in a way that we wouldn't normally get from a journalist or from just normal reports. The two extremes of sadness and anger are pretty well displayed in these memes.
Jason Lee is a cartoonist and designer who splits his time between Hong Kong and Canada. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Venezuela and Brazil have their own migration crises and their own shelters on the border.
Families stay in small white buildings, subdivided into rooms filled with bunk beds. People lay on thin mattresses, reading magazines, or sleeping.
A special report from northern Brazil, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. We hear a lot about American exceptionalism, but there is one country that in many ways compares pretty closely to the U.S., Brazil, in our own hemisphere. Like the U.S., it's the biggest country, population-wise, on its continent. It also has a problematic history of slavery and treatment of indigenous people. And now both Brazil and the U.S. are governed by so-called strongman populists who say things that are not politically correct, and throngs of people adore them for it. And critics say both men are chipping away at the foundations of democracy. The World's Roopa Shenoy was recently in Brazil, exploring many of the similarities and differences between what's happening there and here. Hey, Roopa.
Hi, Marco.
I think this is a great idea, comparing the U.S. and Brazil, especially right now. Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, like Trump, I mean, he's as much a disruptor as he is a character, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Bolsonaro is an ex-army captain, a longtime congressman. He's far-right, pro-gun, anti-political correctness. He said racist things, homophobic things.
And what's he done as president so far?
He's already made a lot of controversial moves, like cutting the education budget and proposing more military schools. And we'll be talking about that later this week. In many ways, he seems to want to go back to the days of dictatorship in Brazil, and that scares a lot of people.
Right, back to the 1960s. What about on immigration? Because that's Donald Trump's big issue, and Brazil has a border with Venezuela, right?
Right. There's no wall or fence between Brazil and Venezuela. People can walk between the two countries, and they do, but it's a long march through rough terrain. The easier way is driving. There's just one road from Venezuela to Brazil. It runs through the small city of Pacaraima.
Ah, como de llegar hoy?
24-year-old Rosangela Gonzalez sits on a suitcase next to the road, breastfeeding her newborn baby.
Camilo.
Camilo, that's his name. Back home in Venezuela, she couldn't find him a doctor or food. The situation drove Gonzalez and her husband here. They're joining her father-in-law, who's already in Brazil. For now, they've asked the Brazilian government for shelter.
We'll probably be allowed into the shelter because we have a child. But single men traveling alone, it's more complicated for them.
Gonzalez and her family would face a very different situation than they do now if they had arrived here last summer.
Tensions boiled after a local shopkeeper was robbed and beaten. Venezuelans were blamed. In return, locals attacked the immigrants' two makeshift camps, firing shots and burning their belongings.
It made international news when residents of Pacaraima chased hundreds of Venezuelans back over the border. Doña Jeta, Mrs. Jeta, has owned a restaurant on a main drag here for 30 years. Everyone in Pacaraima knows her and tells her everything, she says. And everyone will tell you the same thing. She says they feel like they've been portrayed as the bad guys. Meanwhile, Doña Jeta's restaurant has gotten broken into twice.
Before, I'd stay here until midnight. Now I can't do that. It's too dangerous to walk the streets then. Who wouldn't be upset by that? Anybody would be.
For Doña Jeta, the issue was crime in her neighborhood. That's it. She didn't care about geopolitics. But in Brazil and across the world, leaders were discussing regime change in Venezuela. In January, President Trump hinted at possible military action to help overthrow President Nicolas Maduro and put opposition leader Juan Guaido in his place. That same month, the new president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, took office. He sent humanitarian aid to the border to send into Venezuela. In response, Maduro shut the official border crossing in Pacaraima for 3 months. Venezuelans kept coming on foot. Single migrants, mostly men, slept on the streets of Pacaraima or at the bus station. But by the time the Venezuelan government reopened the border, there was another option for families because the Brazilian military had been deployed at the border. All three branches of the country's armed forces have roles in a sprawling encampment set up to receive the incoming Venezuelans. Inside a big room with wooden benches, families wait for hours for a series of appointments to get their documentation or a mandatory vaccine or to see a doctor. If need be, families stay in small white buildings subdivided into rooms filled with bunk beds. People lay on thin mattresses, reading magazines or sleeping. They seem to be on friendly terms with the troops. Some soldiers end the day attending a recital by Venezuelan children. The atmosphere here is respectful and relaxed, and that's surprising given what Bolsonaro said about immigration. When he was a congressman, he called refugees the scum of the earth. And he's supported Donald Trump's immigration policies. Here he is on Fox News, speaking through an interpreter.
The vast majority of potential immigrants do not have good intentions or do not intend to do the best or do good to the U.S. people.
Still on the ground, Brazil is welcoming to migrants, for now.
O nosso objetivo, né, dentro do abrigo, é primeiro tratar o ser humano, humanidade, né?
Our goal is humanity, to treat the human being.
Major André Albuquerque runs one of the largest family shelters in the city of Boa Vista, 3 hours' drive from the border. The refuge houses more than 1,000 people and is almost full. It's raining hard today, and the ground is quickly turning to mud.
Eu acho que, em primeiro lugar, a gente, o latino, ele tem uma essência sentimental muito forte.
I have a family, I have a wife, I have children. I try to look after the refugees as if they were my own children and family members.
Brazil's doing a lot more than just providing shelter. The country set up a system to integrate arriving Venezuelans by sending them to other parts of the country, where there are jobs that need filling. It's not like in the U.S. Migrants get documentation within a day or two, which allows them to work in Brazil right away. Daryl Huard, a Canadian refugee officer with the United Nations, helps match Venezuelans with possible employers.
It's a very unique program, to be honest.
Huard says it's rare for the UN to work so closely with the military. But in this case, he says, it's working.
I mean, you can look around you. It's just amazingly well-organized.
Well-organized and well-funded. Huard says countless organizations are helping here. International aid agencies, UNICEF, USAID. And he says a lot of the financial support has long come from the U.S. In 2018, the U.S. gave the UN Refugee Agency more than $17 million to help with Venezuelan migrants. That's increased to nearly $28 million so far this year.
I don't want to be critical because realistically what's happening there is very unique. I'm talking about at the U.S.-Mexican border. But in terms of the support the U.S. government and the American people give in general through NGOs, it's extremely important, and it's a huge portion of what we do comes from the U.S. So the American people are doing a really good job. It just may be that it's not being shown enough in the media because they're doing it indirectly.
But there's always the possibility that U.S. funding could be cut. And despite all the effort and money, there are people who are left behind, like single Venezuelan migrants who sleep for weeks at the bus station because they can't get into shelters, or people who choose against being relocated, like Ruber Monero and his family. He says they stayed in Venezuela as long as they could, but a year ago, they had to come here. Monero lifts his 2-year-old daughter, Raquel, to show her back.
She's going to need surgery. This bone here, she has a bone spur.
He says she was in a local Brazilian hospital for months, but she still needs an operation.
Hospital officials tell me they can't help, that they don't have the resources. I have all the documentation. I just need a surgeon to sign off.
Monero still thinks she has a better chance of getting an operation here, relatively close to the border, where the military is mobilized to help refugees. That's why he hasn't enrolled in the voluntary relocation program. Monero admits there's another reason, too.
Well, I'm hoping that one day Venezuela changes, that Maduro goes.
He dreams of life back in Venezuela, of reuniting with his parents and living in his own home, rather than a makeshift shelter.
It's not so nice to live like this. The mattresses all get wet when it rains. Tonight we'll be sleeping on wet mattresses.
But, he says, they'll still be grateful for shelter, and grateful to the Brazilian government. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Boa Vista, Brazil.
We're going to be hearing Rupa's stories from Brazil throughout this week. Tomorrow, she looks at how the new Brazilian president is stirring up a centuries-old debate about which lands belong to indigenous people. New York City spent hours in the dark this weekend. Investigators are still trying to figure out what went wrong, what causes blackout. Managing the flow of power is an incredibly complex thing, one that most people don't think about until the power isn't there. But it's something that people are paying a lot of attention to in places like Germany and the UK. The power systems in those countries can be disrupted by an unexpected advance, a surge in renewable power like solar or wind. Rachel Kalidas is the policy director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Why are renewables a challenge for grids?
The challenge we have currently is that our grid has been built for the past. So we've been operating with this current form of the grid that was built around fossil fuel-fired energy, mainly big, hulking, centralized plants that were generating electricity and transmitting it to population centers. The opportunity that we have here right now is that as we're trying to cut our carbon emissions, we have to upgrade this grid so that it's able to integrate resources that are not just these centralized power plants, plants, but actually a much more decentralized system of power generation. We've got wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, different forms of renewable energy that are dispersed widely around the globe. And the question is building a grid that can help integrate these decentralized generation sources and do the same thing, bring it to the population centers where people live. And that's why sometimes we are running into these challenges, because we're not making the investments in the grid simultaneously as we're integrating more and more levels of renewables.
Grids, basically, it sounds like what you're saying, have to be able to change the wheels on the bus while it's moving. So like in Germany, how's it looking? Are they having intermittent power, or what does that look like?
Actually, no, it is not a situation where they have intermittent power. What they are able to do is by being integrated into a grid where they have power resources, both within Germany, but also integrated into the European electricity grid. Somewhere there will be electricity available, even if it is coming from a variable resource like wind and solar. And ultimately, the technical challenge that grid operators face is making sure that moment to moment, as you said, they're balancing the electricity supply with the demand. So if they have a grid that's spread over a wide geographic region, they're able to call on more resources if the wind is not blowing strong enough in one particular area or the sun is not shining enough in one particular area. They're able to call on other resources and balance power demand and supply in the moment. The other key piece is to be able to balance these variable resources with something like energy storage. So whether that's storage in the form of batteries or storage that comes from pump storage, hydropower, for example, that you can deploy should a variable resource not be available in that moment. And as battery technology improves, which it is steadily doing now, as well as its costs come down, the opportunity to twin storage with variable renewable electricity is truly tremendous.
So the United States is slowly but surely taking on renewable energy. What are some of the challenges and vulnerabilities here in the U.S.?
The challenge here has been, how do you integrate higher and higher levels of renewables without causing constraints in the grid? And those challenges come in different forms. You could have a lot of renewables that come online at a time of day when that much electricity is not needed. And one of the things that they're trying to do is try to make sure that they're able to actually manage this problem on the demand side, not just the supply side. So are there people with flexible power demand that can move their energy, electricity consumption to different parts of the day when we have more renewables coming online? And one interesting opportunity here is electric vehicles. Those vehicles can charge at times of day that are non-peak, where there are not a lot of customers requiring the electricity, and then essentially use any other time of the day. So they perform a kind of like a proxy electricity storage device, so to speak.
Rachel Cletus is the policy director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Trump's tweet to go back to the countries it came from, directed at four members of Congress, was racist and offensive. It also didn't make much sense. Three of the congresswomen were born in the United States. But forget the actual tweet for a moment. Some immigrants do go home, but not because anyone told them to. Many immigrants, and not just those who moved to the United States, feel a need to keep feet in two worlds, the old and the new. Somali-Canadian journalist Hodan Nalia did. Nalia was born in Somalia in 1976. She moved with her family to Canada when she was 6 years old. In 2014, she founded an online platform called Integration TV and traveled back and forth from Canada to Somalia to cover stories about how Somalis were working to rebuild their home. Here, Nalia describes reaching out to the Somali diaspora with news of their homeland.
The narrative for the past 25 years has been war, has been conflict, and part of it is, some of it is true, but that's not the only story. There's other stories. There's other stories of people who live in a great country where 98% of the country is safe, and there's just one city that usually tends to have problems. So as somebody who cares about sharing human stories, war is one element of it. There is the mother who has, you know, children that she wants to provide for, who's selling camel milk on the streets in Somalia. I mean, is her story any less valid than the guys who are bombing the cities?
This weekend, Nalia had a fatal encounter with those guys who were bombing the cities. She and her husband were in a hotel in the Somali port city of Kismayo when militants of al-Shabaab attacked it. At least 26 died. Producer Lior Khananayev worked closely with Nalia at Integration TV. We caught up with Lior earlier today in a busy part of Toronto.
Well, Hoden could have lived a regular North American life, but she chose to get out of her comfort zone and follow her dream. She tried to reconnect a broken Somalian community. Her show catered to Somalians and Somalian youth and the diaspora. She really tried to bring positivity to the country because that country, you know, it had a very tough history and people just really suffered there. And unfortunately, it has a bad light on it.
What kind of people did she profile? Who did she find interesting?
The local heroes that you don't see on the news. She tried to tell positive stories about the community, and she would dedicate her days into finding the people that the community wants to hear about. Because unfortunately, a lot of people just see Somalia as this country that has a lot of negativity to it.
Lior, you and Hodan were of very different backgrounds, and yet you became fast friends. What did you learn about Somalia from Hodan?
I learned that even though the community is very broken, it's also very tight. And the more damaged you are, the closer you are together as a community. And, you know, I think the Somalian culture is in a rebuilding phase. And Hoden was really in the middle of it all.
Producer Leo Hananayev, who worked closely with Hodan Nalia at Integration TV in Toronto. Thank you very much. Our condolences to you today.
Thank you for having me.
At least 25 other people were killed in the attack on the hotel in Somalia this weekend. Al-Shabaab claimed credit for the incident. The U.S. has been battling extremists in Somalia for nearly three decades. Black Hawk Down took place there in 1993. Al-Shabaab materialized a decade or so later. Bronwyn Bruton is the deputy director at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. She follows the Horn of Africa and says the Western-backed Somalia government has been a target of al-Shabaab since the early 2000s.
It's very typical for them to strike any kind of hotel, restaurant, or government office where either government officials or people supporting or engaging with the government would be located. It's important for us to understand that al-Shabaab is not in a conflict with the United States. The U.S. has been constantly hitting al-Shabaab with strikes this year, 50 so far, which is a massive escalation already over last year, which was a massive escalation of strikes the previous year. Al-Shabaab is primarily interested in local politics. They want to control Somalia, and their primary reason for existing is to fight the Somali government, not the U.S. And so I think that the airstrikes have made it less easy for them to attack the government, but they definitely, as this strike is probably intended to show, they are definitely able still to launch these massive attacks, which is an indication that the airstrikes are not working very well.
Yeah, so what are those airstrikes accomplishing?
Well, I think there's some evidence that they are putting great pressure on al-Shabaab, and there's some splintering with al-Shabaab as a result. But I think even the AFRICOM leadership has been quite candid that it's not very likely that these airstrikes are going to destroy al-Shabaab or even debilitate the organization. The problem is that the government has been stalled for 10 years, and the U.S. has spent millions on millions of dollars trying to train soldiers for the government that keep on defecting. And there's really no command and control in the Somali army, and there's not a strong sense of loyalty. So it's primarily a set of political problems that are not going to be solved through military force. And the American government, in using military force and drone strikes in particular, is running the risk of alienating the Somali people because obviously civilians are increasingly being caught up in these strikes.
Does the U.S. have a policy for bringing peace to Somalia?
The U.S. doesn't have any kind of a plan for bringing peace to Somalia. It's consistently said that it's trying to build a government, it's trying to empower the government, but it's not elected. And I think there's still a lot of uncertainty in Somalia about what a government should look like, and certainly a lot of dissatisfaction about what this particular government looks like. Across the country, you see regional administrations popping up that are basically clan fiefdoms, all of whom are at odds with the central government. It's really been a case of one step forward, two steps back.
What do you think is the best way the U.S. can help Somalia right now?
In my view, the best thing that the United States can do is to negotiate with al-Shabaab. We have for many, many years described al-Shabaab as a terrorist organization, but that's not all that they are. Although they have been very harsh, they've also increased the rule of law and act, and a lot of Somalis depend on them. And I think what's important for the U.S. is to try to recognize the things that al-Shabaab has accomplished and find a way to coexist with them and to negotiate with them to get them to agree, for example, not to target neighboring countries, not to target Christians. It's also important to point out that al-Shabaab's relationship with al-Qaeda has been quite tempestuous. As far as partners go, they've been a pretty poor one. And I think that the alliance is quite weak. And so, again, the possibility of working with al-Shabaab to perhaps draw them away from al-Qaeda and find a way to coexist with them is not impossible.
Bronwyn Bruton with the Atlantic Council in Washington. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thanks, Marco.
That's going to do it for us today. The world's theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.